out as ship's boys. "I've never heard the words competent and admiral in the same sentence," she replied with an arch expression and a bit of furious fan-waving which denoted it as a sally. It turned to a smile when laughter ensued, along with calls of, very droll indeed, Lizzie." Brazier was obliged to give a brief outline of his career, how he'd come to the Navy through his father's service as a ship's surgeon, added to the good offices of a serving captain who esteemed him. There were years of very little happening, several sojourns ashore on half pay, too. "And there was, it has to be said, very little in the way of action until I sailed to the Cape of Good Hope under Commodore Johnston."
"Braddock was with you, he told me."
"He was captain of one of the 74s. Brazier went on to describe the part failure at the Cape, redeemed by the destruction of a dozen Dutch merchantmen, then the success at Ceylon, which saw him get his step.
"And then the West Indies, captain?"
"Dull service, Miss Carter," was his quick response. It was a place to which he did not want to go. "Repetitive in the extreme." There was a glint in her eye which told Brazier she knew more than she was saying, which made him wonder if Braddock had been subjected to some untoward gossip through the naval grapevine. Then, of course, she'd just come down from London and moved in elevated circles when there. Who knew who was saying what? It was with gratitude he heard her address another guest to inquire on a new translation of Ovid, a subject on which he could happily stay silent. The noise of children at Cottington Court was so unusual, it brought almost all the servants out to have a look at an apparition only the oldest of them could recall. And in the Colpoys trio they had noisemakers of quite exceptional ability, able to render their presence known within seconds of them alighting from the coach. Even within his study at the rear of the house, Henry picked up a bit of their squealing and was obliged to come out to investigate. "What is going on?" This was addressed to his aunt, standing at the bottom of the stairs.
"Visitors for Elizabeth, Henry, and before you inquire, it was at my invitation."
The look past him could only mean his sister was coming down the stairs. And with Grady standing within easy hearing distance, it was no place for remonstrating, though it could not just be allowed to pass. "I would have been obliged if I had been asked."
"Why trouble you, nephew?"
Sarah Lovell replied with the tiniest over-the-shoulder flick of the eyes.
"You are so busy. Anyway, it's Annabel Colpoys, Elizabeth's best friend and her children. We thought to take them down to the lake, and perhaps they could even fish."
Henry spun enough to glare at Betsy, for if he felt he had enough cause already to hate her, to that was added even more as he recalled that location and the number of times he had been used there, when home from school, as a verbal punch bag for their childish games. "Make sure none of them drown," was said in such a fashion that the sentiment was questionable.
"Grady, our outdoor clothing, if you please, and could you ask cook to make some of her delicious shortbread for the Colpoys children? I'm sure they will devour it. They can eat in the kitchen. We adults will take tea in the drawing room at 4 o'clock. Please send someone to fetch us at the appropriate time."
If Henry did not hear it all, what he did pick up was enough to cause a slammed door, which produced from his aunt a smile and a remark.
"Must be the wind."
Chapter 25. Had there ever been such a fractured conversation? Betsy wondered if it was actually possible to make full sense of any message delivered or information exchanged, one or two words at a time. Yet that was the purpose, while throughout she had to formulate a reply and articulate the difficulties that must be faced. She was made aware Edward had visited Annabel, though little of what they might have talked about could be properly imparted. It was as much by look as speech that her good friend let her know she was aware of her true situation. After the loss of Upton, and that plan being destroyed, Betsy knew she was under observation wherever she went, even within the grounds of Cottington. Annabel must have seen the way the coachmen were armed, for when that was whispered over carrot-coloured hair and a fishing rod, there was no shocked reaction. It was necessary to keep a constant watch on Sarah Lovell, who, if she could help it, was never far away from Betsy. The only method of detachment was provided by the children, with their natural needs and ability to get into situations requiring adult intervention, which included the two boys fighting. With no experience of such creatures, she was too slow to react. Betsy was no better served in that regard, but youth allowed for swift movement. Edmund, the eldest boy, was bossy, indeed cocky, and sure he could look after himself. Roger Jr. wanted so much to be older and sought to do as well, if not better, than his brother in all the activities. Tree climbing, stone skimming, and rod casting. Both were miniature versions of their father, while Hermione, the youngest, was a sweet child who took after her mother and was quite content making daisy chains or knotting long pieces of grass. The conclusion to tell him to find a way had to wait until Roger got stuck up a tree, with, thankfully, Aunt Sarah too afraid to help in getting him down in case he dropped upon her. "He needs a sign," Annabel hissed. "Not possible," Betsy gasped, as heavy-boned Roger landed in her arms. When the servant arrived to say tea would soon be served, the pair had done better than they knew. Obliged on the way back to stop communicating in anything other than banalities, both could assess what had been established. Since no fixed arrangement could be made with Edward, Betsy would have to be ready to decamp at a moment's notice and with nothing in the way of possessions. If it was fraught with the potential to go wrong, that just had to be accepted. Desperate times required desperate actions. Vital to Betsy was his obvious willingness to make whatever effort it took to get her free. Against that, she was frustrated, as she had been at Home Farm, at not being able to talk properly to Annabel, to tell her about the hell she was going through, Henry's behaviour, and most of all, how close she'd come to getting away. And here, as they walked, was her Aunt Sarah, burbling on about days spent in the Blean Woods around Canterbury, picking wild flowers and sometimes, in the right season, mushrooms. In her story, every day was sunny, all the people accompanying her and her dear Samuel clever and amusing. "What an idyll, my dears, I cannot tell you," she trilled. This while Betsy stopped herself from pointing out she'd been doing nothing else for a good 20 minutes. "I shall ask Henry to join us for tea, Aunt Sarah." That stopped the trilling and reminiscing. Sarah Lovell went right back to the way she'd been in Jamaica, and since, looking censorious. "I have had recent disagreements with your brother, my dear, but on one thing I cannot gainsay him. Nothing will be achieved if you don't talk to each other." Annabel aimed a swift eye movement in her direction, making it plain there was a flaw in this logic. Sarah Lovell responded in a low voice so as not to be overheard, which was unnecessary given Edmund was being roundly chastised for punching young Roger so hard he'd started to cry. "Annabel being present will prevent the raising of anything intimate or likely to bring on dispute, but it will also serve to provide the kind of gentle conversation during which you might find it is not impossible to communicate. He will need to be as polite and constrained as you." The problem came in Henry's downright refusal to comply with the request, which obliged his aunt to explain to her guest that his affairs were so complex he was mired in paperwork. The expression on Annabel's face was unobserved, but it told Betsy her friend thought Henry was mired in something, and paper was not it. The children, full of fresh milk and covered in crumbs from shortbread, were obliged to say how much they'd enjoyed themselves, and Betsy reckoned it was part truth. No adults would have been better. but it was enough to have her aunt say they must come again, which was a positive. She was more guarded and tactical when asked about the day, saying, instead of outright repudiation, that she found the children exhausting. Aunt Sarah, who'd had little real contact with them, pronounced herself enchanted with their vital spirit. The result was achieved. It would not have done for Betsy to have shown any enthusiasm of a kind that might cause suspicion as to her motives. She could retire to her room and work out a way to get either a message or a signal to Edward, saying to come and get her as soon as he thought the situation propitious. And then she was afforded time to reflect on the way much of the day's activities had seemed so normal, in contrast to the reality. Annabel had been wonderful, never once putting a foot wrong. The danger lay in what she knew, but must never allude to, even obliquely, and that had been carried off with aplomb. In addition, Betsy decided, for all she had harboured previous reservation about children, and the Colpoys brood in particular, it was possibly a thing to hanker after, in an imagined and happy future. "Someone to see you, Your Honour," said Joe Lascelles, as Brazier came through the front door, his hat taken. "Again, I seem to be becoming popular. Easy error to make," Joe sniffed before grinning and indicating the drawing room. The man within, not one in his first youth, who shot to his feet on entry, was no more comfortable in these surroundings than Daisy Trotter had been in the card room. That was a recollection that reminded Brazier he'd behaved badly, and unnecessarily so. With that thought in mind, it was a moment before he inquired as to the nature of the fellow's business.
"I was sent here by Miss Elizabeth, sir."
His heart was very suddenly in his mouth.
"Miss Langridge, you mean?
If she can still be styled that, after recent happenings."
"She has sent you with a message?"
"Not quite, sir."
The fellow was clearly nervous, and being towered over by a saturnine and hard-faced naval officer, who looked set to board an enemy deck, was not going to help.
"Please sit down again, as will I. And I have yet to inquire your name."
"Upton, sir. Ed Groom at Cottington Court. Till yesterday."
"What happened yesterday?"
"Mr. Tulkington showed me the gate."
"I sense you have a tale to tell me. Have you been offered refreshment?"
"Your servant was kind enough to do so, but..."
"Then allow me to get you something. Beer and a sandwich, perhaps."
Joe was ordered to fetch a tankard from the nearby King's Head Tavern, while Cocky was tasked to knock up some bread and cheese, as Brazier extracted from Upton the tale he wanted to tell in the time he wanted to tell it, which began with his service to Mr. Henry's father as a stable lad. There was surely something he would come to, words Brazier was eager to hear, but this Upton would not be pushed. He wanted to be understood, and it was possible to be thankful for naval service and command, for that had given Brazier much experience in dealing with such men. Not all tars were of the garrulous type, and Upton was certainly slow to relate his story, not aided by simultaneously eating and drinking.
"Worked my way up, over the years," he munched, "only to be shown the gate like some kind of beggar."
"The reason?"
was asked with some suppressed exasperation.
"Sought to aid Miss Elizabeth. Call her that, sir, 'cause I've known her since she was born, and I have to say she was a delight as a growing girl, for she loved a horse, as I do. Have to take to the animals, given the position. If you find them awkward, it will never serve."
"Quite."
"Not like Mr. Henry. Not horses for him, or dogs. I'm taking it you know somewhat of her situation."
"You set out to help her?"
was asked with some relief. But there was no need to answer the question Upton posed. A nod sufficed.
"Escape, sir. Plan was to get her out through the north gate, but we must have been seen plotting, for Mr. Henry was awaiting when I came back from talking with Miss Elizabeth, and there was never a chance to lay out an excuse."
"Did she give you a message for me?"
Never had the chance.
Then I'm curious as to what brought you to my door.
Her instruction. That if anything went awry and I suffered, I was to come here. Go to Quebec House, she told me. And if I had trouble of finding it...
You're here now.
Was designed to stop another litany. Am I to throw myself on your charity, Your Honour?
I dare say Betsy would want it, so that is how it will be. But I had hoped for some words for me personally.
Might be in possession of somewhat better.
Which is?
The tankard was laid aside, and his sack of possessions pulled to sit between his feet. A rummage produced that which he was seeking, and as it came out, it produced in Brazier only confusion.
Key, Your Honour. Opens the padlock on the north gate.
From which side?
Upton had not thought of that, for his face showed concern.
Inside.
Brazier stood to take it from his hand, feeling the weight and pondering.
You will berth here, Mr. Upton. One of my men will show you where you will sleep.
John Hawker's intentions were not without risk. He had to take away early from the slaughterhouse enough of his men to overcome Brazier and his support, without leaving so few that it hindered keeping a firm grip on Spafford and his lot. That would be difficult, given they would be assembled to be the lead element of the mob. That was a task his employer would have wanted him to undertake himself to get things moving before fading out of view. But he could not be in two places at once. Not for the first time he was glad of the distance from Cottington to Deal. Not in truth great, but enough to deter Henry Tulkington from being a constant presence. The latest information he had from one of his scouts was that Brazier had returned home from visiting a neighbour, and he and his men were within Quebec House seemingly settled, so it was possible to time how matters would be handled. As soon as twilight was well advanced, he could move to take his revenge, surprise being his advantage.
We go in through the window and quick, in case the door has a chain. The noise will alert the street, but we must not care for that. I have my pistol, which I will use if we are threatened by one holding the same, but I want it to be clubs and a proper thrashing for all. No exceptions. Timed right, we'll have done the necessary and be on our way afore the crowd gets close.
"Don't we get to take part in the torching, John?"
asked Marker, one of his most trusted men.
"You might. I best not.
Face too well known."
He was not going to say that he'd been ordered not to.
"You have the right of it there. Now you lot spread out and see if we can put some fire into a few beach folk bellies. Get 'em proper fired up and willing to burn the bastard out, but listen out for the bells of St. George's. And when they strike seven, I want them setting a light to torches and you back here."
As usual, when the day's work drew to a close for those who worked the beach, it was time to claim your spot in your favourite drinking den, to swap ale and a tail with your mates. The women who vended fish had been ensconced for hours, having packed up their stalls much earlier, salting what fish they'd failed to sell and dropping both crabs and lobsters into creels, left far enough out from the beach to be underwater for the night. When it came to raging against perceived injustice, no one could hold a candle to the Deal fishwife, and they were just as partisan on behalf of their menfolk, fathers, husbands, and sons. Many of those subsisted in a meagre existence but for the occasional run across the channel. It was a fair bet they knew the names of the fellows who had done for and buried that too-nosy exciseman, but it would never pass their lips, barring a whisper in the ear of one known to be safe. The other thing in which they could match their men was in consumption of drink, gin being their favoured tipple. Having had a couple of hours' head start, they were ripe for stirring up by the likes of Marker, especially since he was willing to stand a flask or two. By the time the menfolk joined them, the fuse had been well and truly lit for activity instead of talk. Brazier, being chastised, had gone from if to when, the only pity being they could not get Billy Pitt at the same time. Dan Spafford was rubbing chafed and sore wrists, which had been in shackles for days now. He had no difficulty in doing what was being asked of him. Getting free was the most important thing. He needed to earn, so he needed to smuggle. And then there was his boy. There was no way to get Harry free of Tulkington if he was chained up, or if Hawker got his way, rooming with Davy Jones in his locker. Finally rejoining his men, he was glad to see the relief on their faces. For him being free meant they were too, and it did not have to be said. Most were convinced they'd been for slaughter and the pork barrel, so it was not a surprise that one or two had a tear, thinking they'd avoided such a fate. The first thing he did was ask how the hell they'd come to be here in the first place, listening with increasing gloom as he heard what had happened while he was locked in Tulkington's cellar, which included being told about another party of hard-looking souls getting involved, one of whom had a pistol pointed at Tulkington's head, with no other explanation provided. With so many seeking to explain, what they sought to describe was garbled and unclear. That it was beyond odd just had to be accepted. More important was what was to be done now, the tale of which produced some very glum faces, a sentiment he shared but which had to be put aside.
"You will know it don't sit well with me to do Tulkington's bidding, but do it we will. For once it's over, we can get back to our own hearth."
"Will Daisy be there?"
asked Dolphin Morgan, called that because he was reckoned to be as dense as the wood of the beach berthing posts.
"Since I has been as locked away as you have, and he ain't here, I don't know how you reckon me to answer that."
"Just wondering, if he weren't with you and he weren't with us."
"It could mean he's free."
"Or pegged it."
"Remind me, when I'm low, to ask you to cheer me up. Now listen hard, you all. This is what we're set to do."
On a warm evening with twilight coming, there was a southerly wind blowing up from Spain, and a gut replete with gin as reward. Hawker's watching urchin, sitting with his back to the navy yard wall, nodded off, so he did not see the five souls exit Quebec House, making their way to the corner, turning down towards the lower valley road. Left behind by agreement was the former head groom, who was not much of a drinking man and was also so happy to have a room to sleep in. It was as if he feared to go through the front door lest he never get back in again. Upton felt he might have landed on his feet, for the man Miss Elizabeth had sent him to was going to talk to another called Flaherty, who had a set of paddocks and stables about giving him a place. Part of the reason for going out was so they could talk without Upton being given a chance to overhear their discussion. What to do with the acquired key, which Brazier had in his pocket. The card room was out for them as a group, but the main tavern area was quiet, it being early for the kind of clientele who favoured the old playhouse. As soon as they were sat round a table with drinks in front, it was Pedler who said what was at the back of more than one mind, if not Brazier's. "Was it not a bit too convenient, the key turning up as it had, with a fellow not one of them knew, apart from what he himself had related? Sorry, Captain. Wishing for him to be an honest fella don't make it so." "Good way to catch us, knowing how we'll get in," Dutchy added, emboldened by what Pedler had said.
"We don't have to get in that way,"
Brazier insisted.
"Walls like that will not stop us using grappling irons."
"But the getting out," Dutchy added. "Can't see your lady hauling herself up a rope like a boarder."
Pedler wasn't finished.
"Caught in the act of abducting. Must be a tariff in irons for that."
"She would save us from that," Joe said.
"I don't think it's a trap,"
Brazier insisted, partly in desperation.
"But if you fear to go along..."
"Now that, Captain,"
protested an offended Cocky Logan,
"is no fear."
Dutchy made a strong point.
"We got out last time, Captain, by the skin of our teeth. Without we had that Hawker sod as hostage, we would have been done for."
"Joe, your opinion?"
"If I smell a rat, Captain,
I am minded to set it a trap. It was a discussion that went round in circles for an age as the light outside faded towards night, with the bells of St. George's Church ringing the quarter, half, and the hour. In Quebec House, having spent the previous night under a hedge, Upton was happy to lay down and sleep. Chapter 26. Perhaps if the night had been cold, or the wind had been coming in from the northeast, the one generally icy and feared locally for its ability to drag ships from their anchors, the riot John Hawker was seeking to create would have fizzled out like a damp squib. But the southerly was warm enough to add need to a thirst, while being outdoors, even as night fell, seemed the right and comfortable place to be. Dan Spafford had led his men out of the slaughterhouse to take up station halfway between the town and Sandown Castle. He was watching for the first sign of congregating, easy to spot as folk would do so under the flaring exterior torches of the numerous taverns that lined Beach Street. There was barely a corner, or indeed a row of houses which lacked a place to drink, while some boasted more than one. Within them were not only locals, but sailors having a run ashore from their merchant ships, added to some just paid off and spending heavily, as newly ashore tars always did. If they were not concerned by the notion of anybody seeking to control smuggling, they were of a breed ever ready for disturbance, and which port that took place in made no difference. Thus, when the grumbling became louder, they were quick to pick up on the mood and see sport in it. Not content to merely watch, they began to egg on the local malcontents, calling their intentions feeble, which was not an affront to be borne. The first angry group began to form outside the Albion, a favourite watering hole for the Deal fishwives. That was soon joined by others, the flaring of smaller individual torches the signal for the Spafford gang to move. Closer to the town centre, word began to spread of trouble brewing, which had Garlick in double quick time getting up and fitting the stout wooden storm shutters on the windows of the Three Kings. He was not alone. There were other hostelries that were not mere drinking dens, and these too had well-worn drills to protect themselves, normally from a raging sea bursting over the beach, but also irate humans, when the need arose. At the Navy Yard, the officer on duty got wind of trouble and roused out everyone under his command who could wield a marlinspike. He doubled the marine guard on the gate and ensured those needed to back up that position were close enough to do so, and quickly. There was no requirement to protect anything other than that which was Navy. The town could burn and the service would stay where it was. Yet when Admiral Braddock was informed of what was afoot, he had a quartet of marines, with instructions to shoot their weapons if necessary, dispatched to the roadway leading to Miss Carter's house opposite the yard, to ensure protection for her property. Saoirse Rawdon got the news fairly quickly and was thus able to alert the pair of stout and ferocious-looking doormen who manned the entrance. They were told to be extra vigilant, but if it looked too hard to contain, they were to shut the thick double doors and bolt them, locking everyone inside. She then went to tell those already present. Brazier spotted her as she came through the door, but it was some time before she got to his table, nodding to the quartet with him, whom she had met once before.
"I have come to tell you there is trouble brewing."
"Story is life, lady," said Cocky.
"What kind of trouble?" Brazier asked.
"Could be we're in for a bit of a riot. And don't you be asking me the cause."
"You know everything that's going on in the town, or so I'm told."
"That'll be Vincent indulging in flattery."
He couldn't resist it. "Flattery from a flatty."
"That's not the best witticism you ever produced. Even if it has your lads smiling, I'd be thinking you tars a light in the article of drollery."
"There has to be a reason,"
Brazier insisted, as the smiles disappeared.
"Sure, did you not hear? I don't know. Had a feeling there was something brewing this day, but what's it about?"
She shrugged and tightened her lips.
"Anyway, it's not come our way yet. But if it does, and it looks bad,
I'd be locking and barring the door. So if you're planning to leave, now's as good a time as any.
A look around the table established they were happy where they were. And with a wry smile and pat to Brazier's shoulder, she moved on. She's a fine-looking woman, Pedler said to general agreement. As a soft spot for you, Captain. Brazier held up the key, which had been in his hand so long the metal was now warm. Before challenging the amused looks he was getting from around the table, let's stick to the business in hand, shall we? Basil the Bulger's Molly House emptied quickly, the customers dispersing when told something was brewing. It was too often a handy target for those who saw its purpose as devilish or unclean. Daisy Trotter was one of those who had no desire to be caught inside. But out in the fresh air, he felt safe enough to wander up to Beach Street to see how things were progressing. He took the view that, although a disturbance was brewing, it had yet to get beyond the point of being stationary and the shouting of grievances. Still, knowing the intended destination, he was again assailed by the same quandary. Should he go to Quebec House and warn Brazier, or let him suffer for his arrogance? John Hawker was approaching that very address, as Daisy pondered, glad to see the shutters open and a lantern light within. A peer through the low window showed the front parlour was empty, so he raised an arm to call forward his men, all of whom were in possession of long and sturdy clubs. The crash, as the first of those broke glass, was enough to wake the dead, the splintering of wood from the frames holding the small panes less obvious. Enough of the thin strips of wood were shattered to allow the rest to be displaced by boots. So in less than half a minute, Hawker's brutes had pushed their way inside, to be followed by John Hawker, with his primed and loaded pistol. There was no need for him to issue any orders now. His men knew what to do. Clobber the tars as hard as they liked. But not Brazier. The man bent on revenge, wanted him at his feet and begging to avoid his just deserts. Stood in the parlour, waiting. The sound of rushing feet and shouting was evident, but Hawker was not hearing conflict. He had no doubt that Brazier and the men he employed were hard bargains themselves, and would put up a fight even against clubs, but that meant screaming and shouting. It was even more troubling when the house fell silent, to soon resound with the thud of boots moving downstairs at a steady pace. "No sign, John," Marcus said as he entered the parlour, having hesitated briefly in the face of a pointed pistol. "They're not here." The other men had trooped in behind to crowd the doorway, one admitting he'd found one cove on the top floor. Not one of those they were seeking, but had given him a good clubbing anyway. "Out!" Hawker barked, wondering how he'd not been informed. What he then said, in a bitter voice, made little sense to those who heard it. "By the blood of Christ, I'll have those little buggers pay for this." They exited to a deserted street. If any of the neighbours had been disturbed, and they must have been, they were not going to come out of their front doors to investigate what sounded like violence. So they would not have seen the dark-clad figures moving swiftly, if noiselessly, towards the town centre. It was quite some time before, after a long period of silence, one ventured out to look at the smashed window frame, and then decide it was none of his concern. Dan Spafford had moved, seeking to mingle with the knots of those whining for retribution outside the taverns. His shouts that it was time for action got many a cheer. This alerted those ahead that things were warming up and made them ready to be receptive to joining an increasingly numerous crowd. Spafford, torch in hand, was to the fore, to be spotted by Daisy Trotter, who, heart pounding and tears forming, rushed to meet him, yelling his name. "You're free, Dan!" The cries of greeting from the others he ignored, getting alongside his friend, hooking an arm and matching his pace, unable to make sense of what he'd just become part of, and having to shout to make himself heard. "How has this come about?"
"Tulkington's price, Daisy. We've got to burn out some poor bastard who's got the wrong side of him. That done, we're free.
Have the name of Brazier?
Daisy gasped. How in God's name do you know that?
Daisy'd been in a quandary before. It was 10 times that now and required some very quick calculations. This was made harder by Dan pushing into a crowd outside the Three Compasses, urging them to action, and he was not alone. Those already with him, and that excluded his own men, were doing their own encouraging. The crowd were fully up for pandemonium now. Spafford was visibly surprised to have Daisy grab his arm and haul him back with more strength than he was supposed to possess.
You've got to put a stopper on this, Dan.
What the hell are you on about?
The thought of seeking to explain in this situation seemed impossible, but he had to try.
Take my word. It's the wrong way to go. Doing Tulkington's bidding will be damaging our own.
But Daisy...
No fucking buts, Dan! You's got to trust me!
The look of utter confusion on Dan Spafford's face did not provide 1 ounce of encouragement. As Daisy screamed at him, quite prepared to exaggerate, even to lie,
Brazier is more friend to us than enemy. He came close to shooting Tulkington the night we was rumbled. He hates the bastard and will side with us against him.
Tulkington's going to let us carry on in the trade with no interference, Daisy.
Then ask yourself why he's paying that as a price.
Dan, what do you want to do? The crowd's moving on,
demanded Dolphin Morgan. That got a confused look, for Dan Spafford had no idea. It was Daisy who spoke, his face a picture of despair as he looked at the now surging mob, and his voice matched the look.
There's no controlling it now. We's got to get to the front and start the torching, that's the arrangement. No, Dan,
Daisy insisted, for the first time not needing to shout, given the noise of the throng was receding.
We have to get back to Worth and see how we's to proceed. Gotta say no to that, Daisy. Tulkington's got my boy.
Dan's shout came as he started running, calling on his lads to follow, which left Daisy standing alone, silently cursing Harry Spafford's hold on his pa. It took effort to push back to the front of the crowd, but Dan Spafford did not lack for muscle or the odd fist if some sod would not quickly clear a path. The stream of human anger swept past the Three Kings, where Garlick and some of his guests were watching from the open first-floor window, only to come to a halt at the sight of 4 redcoats and raised muskets.
This way!
Dan Spafford, having resumed the leadership, slipped down a narrow alley, one of dozens that connected to Middle Street, with everyone following. The noise, which had been loud on Beach Street, hit a level many times that in the confined space between 2 sets of high buildings, and barely diminished when they poured into Middle Street, the confining lack of space turning the whole into a seething, liquid mass. Now they were shouting the name of Brazier, and in there was many a loud curse aimed at Billy Pitt. Those within the houses along the route heard it, and even if it made no sense, they trembled, praying to be spared whatever was about to occur. This applied especially to those who were neighbours to Quebec House, who, if they dared look out onto their street, were presented with a sea of heads, flaring torches and bellowing imprecations. It was talked of in the aftermath. Maybe if the window had not already been smashed, the torch would not have been thrown through it. It was never to be established who the actual culprit was, while even such an excitable mob was wont to hesitate when it came to the actual carrying out of that which they'd been encouraging each other to do. But once one went through, others followed. The drapes took light quickly to be followed by the furnishings. The crowd had to ease back as the flames took hold, for fear it might singe them. That retreat went further as the glass burst outwards on the first floor, soon followed by lively streaks of red and orange. Quebec House was now well and truly alight, and it was soon remarked that no one had come rushing out of the front door in order to save themselves. Murmurs grew and spread. The place had to be empty.
The purpose of the night had not been met. The person they had lined up for a sound beating was not there to suffer. That, combined with the enormity of what they were gazing upon, had those to the rear begin to slip away, lest there was a price to be paid for this so-called merriment. There were bells ringing, too, as the volunteers who manned the Deal fire engine, paid for and maintained by monies raised by the Tulkington family, responded to the call telling them their services were required. At the same time, word was spreading to those not involved, leading to alarmed and head-shaking denunciations about the endemic stupidity of the lower orders. The news was relayed to Saoirse, known to many as the owner of Quebec House. She passed it on to Brazier's table, which would have had them rushing out of the front door and heading for Middle Street, if she'd not stopped them, with an argument hard to dispute, even as she herself donned a cloak.
"It has to be you they're after, not the house."
"Tulkington," Brazier spat. "More like Eorka," came from Dutchy.
"Stay here," Saoirse insisted. "You can't face a mob, even armed, and certainly not in that uniform."
"And you can?"
"Edward, no one has me marked."
"She's right, Captain," Pedler said, which got a murmur of agreement from Cocky and Joe.
"I will send for you as soon as it's safe to do so."
Then she was gone, leaving a quartet to wonder at what they would find when they did get sent for, which had Brazier cry, "Upton!" Any restraint evaporated, and he was first out the door, his sword hauled out and pointed ahead of him, ready to skewer anyone who got in his way. Behind him, three cutlasses were also shaped for the taking of blood. Only Joe Lascelles, reduced to bunch fists. They came upon the rear of a multitude breaking up, partly because the man who had led and encouraged them had disappeared, and was, unknown to all, heading for the marshes that ran to the north of Deal. Bellowing got Brazier through, for no one wanted to take on the Wild Eyes or the Blade, while behind him his men were swinging right and left looking for flesh. The flames were now shooting out of the roof, while in front of the house the firemen were furiously working their hand pump to send what looked like a feeble stream of water up the exterior walls. Having got too close, Brazier had to fall back in the face of the searing heat, only vaguely aware of a line of the more responsible citizens forming up to pass a line of buckets all the way from the foreshore. Unseen, and only revealed later, there was another group at the rear of the properties trying to damp the flames from there. A second engine came trundling into the street from the Navy Yard, manned by sailors, while behind them their mates paid out a rolled canvas hose to suck water from a well. By the time they had that operating, he found himself standing alongside Saoirse.
"Play on the neighbouring houses," Brazier yelled, saying words that he knew might upset her. "Try to keep it from spreading to them, for the main one is beyond saving."
"What folly caused this?"
she said in a tearful tone.
"Hatred was the cause, Saoirse, and I am sorry to be the reason for it."
The crowd, or at least those who had not got away from potential trouble, had retreated to form blocking lines of bodies. Mixed in with them were the residents of this part of the street, very likely some from the buildings the firefighters were now trying to preserve. It took no great wisdom or knowledge of fires to see that Quebec House was truly beyond saving, for what had been a searing conflagration was now morphing into a great plume of smoke.
"Dutchy, see if you can find Upton anywhere."
"Don't want to leave you unprotected, Captain."
It was in a voice cracked from smoke inhalation that he replied,
"I doubt those who truly want to do me harm have stayed around. Cowardice will see them long gone."
He was there all night, and able in the morning to gingerly enter the ground floor. There were no others, the ones above having crashed down to form a pile of hot wood under a roof open to a sky beginning to lighten. In amongst that, and only found when everything had been drenched in water, they found a body, charred and reduced to the dimensions of a child. It did no good to say to Edward Brazier he was not responsible. He knew he was. Chapter 27.
It was a somber breakfast that was taken in the old playhouse following the discovery of Upton's remains, for it could be no one else. It did mean that whoever had set light to Quebec House was guilty of murder, not, given the size of the crowd who'd been outside at the time, that anyone was likely to be brought to book. The names not mentioned because they would set everyone's teeth on edge were those of Tulkington and Hawker, who, it was suspected, had to be the authors of the whole event. It would not have cheered them to know that Hawker, too, was fuming. The first reason was very obvious. He'd failed to get his revenge. But second was the written instruction from Henry Tulkington, delivered by some stable boy, ordering him to travel to Chatham and bring back to Cottington Court Harry Spafford. No explanation as to why being given. If he was unaware of every detail, Hawker was burdened by a feeling his employer had not handled recent matters very well. From being a man in iron control, he seemed to have moved to where he was seeking to cover one error with another. And now they'd piled upon each other. Spafford and his thieving gang should have been disposed of, that being the only way to ensure a finish. If that threatened to raise problems, well, they seemed to have more now. Refusing to have Brazier as a brother-in-law, he could see. But wedding his sister to drunken and whoring Harry Spafford as a solution, he could not fathom. Prior to departure, he collared a couple of the street ragamuffins, a pair sound asleep, the others being too numerous and fleet of foot to be caught, and gave them several hard blows round the head as well as a promise if they wanted for gin, to find a new chump to provide it. Next came a bit of a tour of various taverns, seeking to ensure his name was not linked to the fire at Quebec House, and in this he was satisfied. The fact of a body being found bothered him, but only in the event it was the wrong one. No one even hinted at him as responsible, but there were plenty willing to tell him who'd been outside while the fire raged. Hawker was tickled, if not surprised, by the general caginess of those he queried, most reluctant to admit they'd been party to the riot at all. But the one name that did crop up suggested a notion. Could he put the blame for the whole thing, not least that dead body, onto the head of Dan Spafford? This might at least get shot of him, which would serve, for without their leader his gang was useless. But a care surfaced at the same time. The sod knew too much about the Tulkington operations and what he got up to with the revenue to be threatened with a rope. Perhaps matters would settle in the time he was away. Brazier and his lot were homeless, and his hopes on Tulkington's sister were dashed so he might well move away. Spafford, if not at the bottom of the sea, was back to where he had been previously. Small-scale smuggling, thus not really a problem. John Hawker was fairly relaxed as he got one of the vans that ran regularly to Sandwich, where he would pick up a coach that would pass through Chatham. Hawker was not alone in reviewing recent events, though he would have been obliged to admit a real difference in conclusion. Henry Tulkington, who would have denied he was feeling sorry for himself, was yet reflecting that fate had dealt him a very difficult hand and in a very short space of time. The coincidence of his problem with Brazier, simultaneously compounded with Spafford's thieving, had obliged him to juggle where he would have preferred to carefully manage. Now he had a feeling his actions to resolve these problems, in which he had lacked both alternatives and room for manoeuvre, were bringing disapproval in too many quarters. He would have to check his Uncle Durley's attempts to intrude in Elizabeth's affairs, which, if it promised to be unpleasant, provided an opportunity for which he'd been only vaguely aware he'd been waiting. The balance of their relationship needed to be set beyond peradventure. The days of him as the novice were long gone. He was fully his father's heir, the man in control, and Durley was there to do his bidding. His aunt would have to be put back in her dependency box. Her behaviour these last few days had been impossible. Worse still, he'd been obliged to acquiesce in the acts she had initiated without even a pretense at consultation. Either she would have to conform to his way of doing things, or he would condemn her to the poorhouse. Then there was his sister, who needed to be forced to accept the present dispensation. He knew her to be willful, but she must come to realize his resolve was stronger. For too long Elizabeth had thought she could act as she wished, thought she could condescend to him, even make him the butt of her and her companion's jokes. Having Spafford here as a threat would help to rein her in, and if she refused, well, he was her husband. Was Hawker still as reliable as he had been in the past? Recently he'd taken to questioning his instructions instead of merely obeying them, putting forward opinions of how to resolve matters that were beyond his responsibilities. The man thought he could not sense his frustration. Hawker should surely have realized by now that his employer had a feline's sense for dissent. It would require to be carefully handled, but Hawker needed to be reminded, quite forcibly, of his place. Spafford he would keep an eye on, and provided he did not overreach himself and stayed well away from the Tulkington operations, he presented no real threat. There was a certain degree of advantage in his trying to compete, albeit in a very small way. Better that the excise had more than one possible target, and he constituted one, a sacrifice if it were needed. As for others like the opportunists of Deal Beach, John Hawker would encourage where it suited, and betray them when it was expedient. A bell was rung to alert Grady that it was time to come and shave him. As he lay back and allowed the razor to go where the man ministering to him felt it necessary, he could reflect that at least in the Department of Menial Service, in the dismissal of Upton, he had asserted his absolute authority. It was in the nature of servants to get ideas above their station, just as it was a requirement of those who engaged such people to occasionally remind them of their dependence. Had he been able to see into Grady's mind, he might not have been so sure of himself.
"Jesus, I'm not offering you my bed, Edward, but a place to lay your head."
Slightly shocked at the openness of her allusion, while also being obliged to put aside the stimulating thought of what that might bring, Brazier had the tricky task of being grateful while determinedly refusing. How could he say that a single night spent here, one in which he'd had no choice being near unable to walk, had very nearly ruptured his relationship with Betsy? He'd been obliged to lie to her to cover for it. The old playhouse was not a place she had ever visited, but that did not mean she had no opinion of what went on within its walls. In truth, a lot less than the more pious citizens of the area supposed. It was bent more towards entertainment than carnality, for there were no attractive young girls pretending to be hostesses while touting for later custom. Yet, in its main rooms, it was a place where a visiting sailor might entertain a woman, one who felt herself too cultured for the more raucous venues or a common tavern. That did not mean said tar was not expecting reward for his attentions and disbursements, while it was certain a fair few succeeded. So it was perceived as not much above a whorehouse. For the likes of a man connected to Betsy Langridge, to cross such a threshold was to enter the devil's lair. Lord knows what she would think if he took up residence.
"I have to see to my men as well, Saoirse, and I still need them with me at all times. So I will ask Admiral Braddock for temporary accommodation until I can find another house to rent."
"You'll struggle there, Edward. Anyone letting to you will reckon their property soon to be torched. You might say you and Pitt being hand in glove is nonsense. There are eejits here about who are convinced it's a fact."
"He did try to engage me on the very purpose they suspect."
That got a reaction, wide open eyes and clear shock.
"I refused."
"And how in the name of Old Nick were you supposed to go about that?"
"Pitt got from Garlic,
loose mouth that he is," she said, butting in,
"that I was involved with the Tulkingtons."
"So he suspects them?"
"The very opposite, Saoirse. He was at pains to tell me how honest and diligent Henry Tulkington is as his damned tax gatherer. Every penny raised paid in, and never a query on his accounts.
So how were you supposed to help?
The connection to Betsy would have put me in the top social layers in this part of Kent. Pitt is convinced smuggling's being done on an industrial scale.
He's not wrong there.
And it's being run by someone of deep pockets and real brains. It is not being carried out on such a level by those whose boats he torched. He suspects one man or a cabal of wealthy individuals of financing and overseeing the trade, well connected to the local magistrates who might themselves be deeply involved. He wanted me to spy on Betsy's friends to see if I could turn up anything useful.
But now you know, so why not tell him?
I rate you clever enough to work that out yourself.
If she thought on it, not much time went by, and what she said in response came out in a way to make him curious, it being half amused but also longing.
Sure, a smitten heart overcomes so much.
Now I must go to see Braddock, and then me and mine must trawl what emporiums there are in Deal. For clothing and everything else, all we possessed went up in those flames.
Best watch out for Hawker.
Wrong, Saoirse,
Razier replied, with some vehemence as he picked up his sword.
He best watch out for me.
Of course, Brazier, Braddock huffed. Circumstances call for a bit of charity, but I'll have to list you as supernumerary to the muster.
His visitor knew what that meant.
I will meet the bill, sir, of course, just as I do so for the stabling.
Pity about Quebec House, and pity the owner. She has not only to rebuild it, but to compensate her neighbours, I hear, for damage to their property. Miss Riordan, or is it Mrs.? No one is quite sure. Fine-looking woman. Be a surprise if no one had bedded her.
I'm sure you mean got her to the altar, sir.
Oh, obviously,
came a blustering response. He hadn't meant that at all. Brazier declined to say that the cost of rebuilding, as well as any other bills, he had promised to meet. This was another connection to the old playhouse and to Saoirse as well, which must be kept from public knowledge.
We have a guest suite here in Admiralty House, Brazier, which you may use.
The ruddy, round face looked gloomy.
Not likely anyone will come down from the board to want to use it.
Obviously, sir, if they do.
Backwater, Brazier,
was stated with more animation. Without there's a war with France, I've said it before, and by damn I will say it again. You'll dine with me tonight, of course.
You're too kind, sir.
Braddock took that not as the platitude it was, but by his expression, as the unvarnished truth. There was a great deal that needed to be purchased. Not even Brazier's sextant had survived the inferno in a fit state to be used. Also gone were some irreplaceable personal possessions, like his mother's locket, which had within miniatures of her and his father. Luckily there were portraits, stored back in Hampshire, which he had hoped would have ended up in a home shared with Betsy. A new sextant could wait till he had a ship, but he required new uniforms, one second-hand and showing it as a working kit, another ordered brand new to replace the much-singed coat and breeches he was wearing. Added to that was a buff coat of the kind favoured by merchant captains, and a tricorn hat to go with it. There were stockings, smalls, shirts, and even hair cues to buy, as well as all things needed for personal care for both himself and his own crewmen. The hardest to find was spare shoes. He took one detour, his back and his purchases fully covered, to the graveyard behind St. George's Church, looking for a plaque in the enclosing brick wall dedicated to Stephen Langridge, Betsy's late husband. There was slight guilt in that he'd not bothered before as he reprised her description of him, which he could not but admit was the polar opposite of his own. Fair-haired and gentle, Brazier was not, and nor was he her cherished childhood sweetheart. Langridge had succumbed to the endemic fevers of the Sugar Islands. He had not. Was it possible she could love two so very different men? This had him reflecting there was no certainty in such an emotion, only the hope that it was the case.
"What's that he's looking at?"
asked Cocky. Dutchy, in receipt of the question, just shrugged. "No idea."
"Have you a notion of what's going to happen now?"
"Why don't you ask him yourself, peddler?"
"You're in better than Cocky and me. I doubt even Joe here gets to know as much about what's on the Turk's mind as you."
Joe Lascelles produced